I'm going to start off with the story of Ernest Hemingway's 1930 car accident that happened just outside Laurel, Montana. And it's an accident that his recovery from has made it into a lot of his work. So we're going to start with that. And this is from Chapter 2, 1930, from Ernest Hemingway in the Yellowstone High Country. So Dos Passos, the Portuguese writer and friend of Hemingway that he had met in World War One, had just come out to the El Barti Ranch to see him. And they hunted for a little while, and then they were going to drive back to Key West together, along with Floyd Allington, who was a hunter and camp cook and bootlegger from Red Lodge. On Halloween night, the two riders, along with Floyd Allington, piled into Hemingway's Ford with warm clothes, blankets, and a quart of bourbon. Allington's fishing prowess had convinced Hemingway to drag him south to ply his skills in the waters off Key West. Allington was excited enough at the idea that he was willing to ride in the rumble seat, wrapped in blankets. The unlikely trio drove through Cook City and the northern part of Yellowstone, camping for the night at Mammoth Hot Springs, within earshot of the retching of a warm geyser. The following morning, they headed out of the park, through Paradise Valley and Livingston, and on towards Billings. Just after dusk, outside of Laurel, they drove into a ditch. Since loose gravel, the lights of an oncoming car, and a car backing out of a driveway were all given as reasons for the crash, it's easy to assume that the bourbon might have had something to do with it. Hemingway broke his arm, and Allington dislocated his shoulder, but Dos Passos escaped unscathed. A passing motorist picked them up and drove them to St. Vincent's Hospital in Billings. Hemingway rode in the back seat with his arm pinned between his knees. Upon checking in, Hemingway was asked his occupation, and he replied, "Writer." And the receptionist, taking in his appearance, wrote on the form, "Writer." The break was serious, an oblique spiral fracture above the elbow, nearly compound. And Hemingway spent the next 7 weeks at St. Vincent's. 3 years later, a graphic description of the wound would appear in Green Hills of Africa. One time, in a hospital, with my right arm broken off, short between the elbow and the shoulder, the back of the hand having hung down against my back, the points of the bone having cut up the flesh of the biceps until it finally rotted, swelled, burst, and sloughed off in pus. While hunting in East Africa, Hemingway would see his injury as crucial to his development as a hunter. Again, in Green Hills of Africa, he wrote, "Alone with the pain in the night of the fifth week of not being able to sleep, I thought suddenly how a bull elk must feel if you break a shoulder, and he gets away in that night. I lay and felt it all, the whole thing, as it would happen, from the shock of the bullet and to the end of the business. Being a little out of my head, I thought perhaps that I was going through a punishment for all hunters. Since I still loved to hunt, I resolved that I would only shoot as long as I could kill cleanly, and as soon as I lost that ability, I would stop." Hemingway had just experienced the best hunting of his life. Although he had shot deer and squirrels as a youth, his experiences in the Yellowstone High Country were on a different level. In the hospital, he was treated by Sister Florence Clunan, entertained by a small transistor radio, and accompanied in his misery by a Mexican gambler who had been shot twice in the gut over a card game. He was fond of Sister Florence and must have had a sense of deja vu given his relationship with Agnes von Karoski during his lengthy hospital stay in Italy during World War I, fictionalized in A Farewell to Arms. The gambler, with his stoic acceptance of his fate, compares well with other characters in Hemingway's short fiction, such as Ole Anderson in The Killers, who, like the Mexican, follows his own stoical code and refuses to denounce his assailants. He is certainly kin to Blindy of A Man of the World, who also refuses to condemn the man who wronged him. In fact, wounding and injury and how men deal with them physically and psychologically is a major theme throughout Hemingway's work. Frederick Henry's injury is central to A Farewell to Arms. Harry Morgan of To Have and Have Not loses an arm. For Whom the Bell Tolls, Robert Jordan breaks a leg, and so on. As Hemingway lay in St. Vincent's, he was dealing with the second serious injury of his first trip to the Yellowstone High Country and the physical and emotional demands that came with them. This episode and its details would work its way into Green Hills of Africa, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and was perhaps the blueprint for the irrational pain and alcohol-influenced behavior of Harry, the narrator of Hemingway's short story masterpiece, The Snows of Kilimanjaro. Hemingway's stay at St. Vincent's was covered by Carlos Baker in his biography and in a Montana Public Broadcasting television documentary entitled Paradise and Purgatory, Hemingway at the El Barti and St. Vincent's Hospital. However, the most entertaining account of the hospital stay is from Hemingway himself. The riotous short story, The Gambler, the Nun, and the Radio, is, according to the author, the absolutely true account of his long stay in Billings. Towards the end of his stay, as his arm healed, Hemingway was able to leave the hospital for short periods of time. He visited the home of his doctor, a renowned orthopedic surgeon named Dr. Allard. The doctor, who liked Hemingway personally, found his writing distasteful and often took him to task for the language he employed. So much so that Allard's son, Joe, remembered that his brother and sister were afraid at times that Hemingway, who appeared to the children to be a bear of a man, would beat up their father. After leaving the hospital, Hemingway and Pauline traveled to her family home in Piggott, Arkansas for Christmas. One day while out walking, still limping and unshaven, Hemingway was labeled a tramp by a large group of school children who chased him through the streets and hurled snowballs at him. He had to take shelter in a stranger's house, and it was here that he met Toby Bruce, who would become Hemingway's driver, handyman, and friend for the next 30 years. Bruce would help shuttle the Hemingway family to and from the ranch for the rest of the decade, and even built the wall that still surrounds the Hemingway home in Key West. The episode quickly turned to Hemingway's dislike for Piggott into hatred, and the Hemingways soon headed back to Key West. The accident and recuperation may have soured the memory of that first year in the Yellowstone High Country, but by the new year, the experience had allowed him to finish his page proofs for the reissue of In Our Time, craft Death in the Afternoon almost in its entirety, and accrue the experience that would later become The Gambler, the Nun, and the Radio. Along with the best trout fishing of his life, he had also shot his first bear, elk, and sheep, seen his first grizzly bear, and accumulated a few new scars and several new friends. Although Floyd Allington had missed the chance to accompany Hemingway to Key West because of the car wreck, Chubb Weaver seized the opportunity and delivered the repaired Ford to Hemingway and stayed on for the rest of the winter for the fishing. Olive and Lawrence Nordquist flew to Key West, and by Valentine's Day in 1931, just over a month and a half after the writer had left Montana, the Hemingways, the Nordquists, and Chubb Weaver were fishing together again 3,000 miles from the Elbert. It was about this time that Hemingway found out that Pauline was pregnant with Gregory, his third son, and second with Pauline. The baby was due in November, which meant the couple would not be able to return to the ranch that year. After traveling to Spain to gather the pictures for the finalizing of Death in the Afternoon, the Hemingways returned to the States for Pauline to give birth. Hemingway had been planning a trip to Africa the next year with his friends, Charles Thompson, Henry Strader, and Archie MacLeish. The research had been done and arrangements had been made. In April 1932, however, MacLeish bowed out. By June, Hemingway had done the same. He suggested his eyesight and the political and social turmoil in America as his excuses, while in reality, Pauline's father was reluctant to fund the trip that summer. This, coupled with his enthusiasm for a return to the Elbert Ranch and the months of fishing, hunt, and hunting it would provide, convinced Hemingway to postpone his first African safari in favor of a return to the Yellowstone High Country. One more motivating factor was that he was seething with damn good stories that he wanted to tell. So that is the story. I'm going to stop reading for a minute. But that car accident and the recuperation in St. Vincent's Hospital is just one example of how Montana and his life in Montana and on the Montana and Wyoming border found its way into his fiction and nonfiction. The Gambler, the Nun, and the Radio is a great story. And it kind of establishes the Hemingway code hero or reestablishes the Hemingway code hero, because the one person in the story that the biographical character looks up to is this Mexican gambler who's been shot but doesn't complain about his injuries and just kind of perseveres. And that is kind of true of almost all of Hemingway's heroes. They all kind of have that in common. But yeah, that accident and the recuperation was also the inspiration, I believe, for Robert Jordan's broken leg and For Whom the Bell Tolls, because the way he describes the break and he describes the bone pushing up the skin but not being a compound fracture, that's exactly how Jordan describes his break and For Whom the Bell Tolls. And also, as I mentioned, Green Hills of Africa. And there's just other experiences up there that find their way into a lot of the work, more so than anything into For Whom the Bell Tolls. For Whom the Bell Tolls, it's set in Spain, but the protagonist, Robert Jordan, is from Red Lodge, Montana. And at one point during the book, I'll read another section. since my eyes have adjusted. So this is from my appendix, my second appendix to the book, and it's just about For Whom the Bell Tolls and Montana's influence on the book. For Whom the Bell Tolls, 1940. While the novel is set in the mountains of Spain, the main character, partly autobiographical and partly fictional, is from Red Lodge, Montana. In shaping Robert Jordan, Hemingway uses Major Robert Merriman, an American fighting with the Spanish loyalists, some of his own biography, and some of his friend Chubb Weaver's biography, and a collage of experiences from his time in the Yellowstone High Country. To lend depth to the character, give him a home, and explain his prowess with guns, horses, and mountain travel, Jordan is a Spanish professor at the University of Montana, explaining his fluency in the language. Much of the natural description in For Whom the Bell Tolls can be traced directly to the Yellowstone High Country. In chapter 14, for example, as the snowstorm moves in, Jordan remembers encountering a moose in similar conditions back home in Montana. In a snowstorm, you rode up to a moose and he mistook your horse for another moose and trotted forward to meet you. In a snowstorm, it always seemed for a time as there were no enemies. This encounter with a moose happened to Hemingway in 1932 as he rode down Timber Creek alone to check the early reviews of Death in the Afternoon. As the novel nears its end, Jordan flashes back more and more to his home in the mountains. In chapter 37, after comparing Maria's hair to that of a marten when released from a trap, he compares the band of Spanish loyalists to his friends in America. Anselmo is my oldest friend, and I know him better than I know Charles, better than I know Chubb. Then I know Guy, and then I know Mike, and I know them well. While Anselmo is a fictional character, the rest of the men mentioned were Hemingway's best friends at that time. Charles Thompson, Guy Hickok, Henry Mike Strader, and Leland Chubb Weaver. And it was Chubb Weaver's son, Tom, who really started me on my journey into Hemingway when he came into my coffee shop with a copy of True at First Light. And he'd been a friend. He was from Red Lodge and would come over the pass to Cook City regularly. And it's just an example of how there is a little bit of living history connecting, still around. You know, Patrick Hemingway still lives here in Bozeman. Tom, unfortunately, has passed away. But I mentioned Otto Toby Bruce earlier, who would drive people to and from the ranch. And his son, Dink Bruce, still lives in Livingston and provided some of the pictures for this book. So really, really crucial to tap into some of these people's memories and just these resources. I actually just spoke with Olive Nordquist's daughter just a little while ago, and she says she has a VHS videotape of Hemingway at the ranch that her mom left her. So we're going to try and dig that out for the conference next year. Okay, and I'll go on. For Whom the Bell Tolls is the novel in which Hemingway deals with his relationship with his father. In addition to the early Nick Adams stories, Hemingway had touched on the subject rather poignantly in Fathers and Sons, and had mentioned his father's suicide in Homage to Switzerland. But Hemingway had not properly addressed this complex adult feelings towards his father until this novel. Hemingway's mother addressed him as a girl until he was 6 or 7 years old, and his father, in an attempt to reverse this trend, had taken young Ernest into the woods every summer to show him how to hunt and fish. On page 338 of the first edition, Hemingway confronts his conflicted feelings about his father through the character Robert Jordan. I'll never forget how sick it made me the first time I knew he was a cobarde. Go on, say it in English, coward. Through Jordan, Hemingway calls his father a coward, not just because of the suicide in particular, but because of the general situation that led to it. In the same passage, Jordan says, "He wasn't any son of a bitch, though. He was just a coward. And that was the worst luck any man could have. Because if he wasn't a coward, he would have stood up to that woman and not let her bully him." Here, Hemingway confronts what he considered his father's greatest failure, and then has Robert Jordan speculate on how his life may have been different if his father had married someone else. So this gets stated in the book, but I haven't really addressed it. But right before Hemingway's first trip to the Yellowstone High Country, his father shot himself. And that suicide and that act haunted Hemingway kind of throughout his life, but definitely through the 10 years in the Yellowstone High Country. And this all kind of comes out in For Whom the Bell Tolls, which is published right at the end of his 10-year stay. In chapter 41, Jordan recalls saying goodbye to his father while leaving home for the first time. For Jordan, this takes place as he is boarding the train in Red Lodge, Montana, to leave for college. For Hemingway, one imagines this taking place as he left Oak Park, Michigan for World War I as an 18-year-old. Jordan recalls, he had taken the train at Red Lodge to go down to Billings to get the train there to go away to school for the first time. He had been afraid to go, and he did not want to know any of it. As his father kisses Jordan goodbye and offers a biblical quotation to convey the emotion of the moment, Hemingway addresses the moment when children finally see their parents as real but flawed people they are. But his mustache had been moist and his eyes were damp with emotion, and Robert Jordan had been so embarrassed by all of it, the damp religious sound of the prayer, and by his father kissing him goodbye, that he felt suddenly so much older than his father and sorry for him that he could hardly bear it. As the train pulls out of the station, Jordan stands on the rear platform of the train watching the water tower at the station grow smaller and smaller until the point that both the station and the water tower are now minute and tiny in the steady clicking that was taking him away. The water tower is an obvious metaphor for his father, and the station represents his home. With the diminishing of his father and the departure from his home, Jordan enters manhood. Clarence Hemingway had committed suicide just before his son's first trip out west. The traumatic event preoccupied the writer through his first time here, and he carried the gun that his father had used to shoot himself with during his time in the mountains. Around guns and death all the time in the Clarks Fork Valley, Hemingway discussed suicide with friends at the ranch and with other friends and family throughout the letters. When trying to channel courage from his grandfather, Robert Jordan laments, "Maybe he sent what little I have through that other one that misused the gun." In chapter 30, there's a detailed account of Jordan dropping the gun that killed his father into a lake in the Beartooth Mountains. And this is from chapter 30 of For Whom the Bell Tolls. He had ridden up to the top of the high country above Red Lodge with Chubb, where they had built that road over to Cook City, now over the pass and across the Beartooth Plateau. Up there where the wind was thin and there was snow all summer on the hills, they had stopped by a lake, which was supposed to be 800 feet deep, and was a deep green color, and Chubb held the two horses, and he climbed out on a rock and leaned over and saw his face in the still water and saw himself holding the gun, and then he dropped it, holding it by the muzzle, and saw it go down making bubbles until it was just as big as a watch charm in that clear water, and then it was out of sight. Then he came back off the rock, and when he swung up into the saddle, he gave old Bess such a clout with the spurs, she started to buck like an old rocking horse. He bucked her out along the shore of the lake, and as soon as she was reasonable, they went back along the trail. "I know why you did that with the old gun, Bob," Chubb had said. "Well, then we don't have to talk about it," he had said. The episode with the gun happened in real life, just as it was described in the novel. According to Chubb's son, Tom Weaver, who lived in Red Lodge until his death in 2017, the lake in question was Froze to Death Lake on the Beartooth Plateau. As For Whom the Bell Tolls comes to its conclusion, we see more and more references to the author's decade in the Yellowstone High Country. As Jordan ties the explosives to the bridge, he takes time to look down at the stream beneath him. As he looked, a trout rose for some insect and made a circle on the surface. The horse that whisks Maria to safety is White Face, much like old Bess, Ernest's favorite horse at the ranch. Robert Jordan's broken bone can be seen pushing up the flesh, much like Hemingway's broken arm in 1930. And as Jordan lies dying, waiting to shoot the officer pursuing his comrades, he has one more thought about his father. "I don't want to do that business that my father did." Then, trying to keep himself from losing consciousness, he tells himself, "Think about Montana." And then finally, the last line of the book, he could feel his heart beating against the pine needle floor of the forest. So that's my second example of Hemingway's time in Montana and Wyoming and Montana, especially finding their way into the work. And that's probably the most important one, because For Whom the Bell Tolls is kind of becoming known as, I don't know, it's my favorite of the novels. And A Sun Also Rises kind of fades from prominence, and Farewell to Arms maybe comes off a little old-fashioned, and you know, maybe with the rise of fascism in the world, and this being about the Spanish Civil War, I think For Whom the Bell Tolls is kind of becoming known as his most important novel, and it really depends on his experiences here, and the protagonist is from Red Lodge, and our the 2020 International Conference is coming next year, And it's also going to be the 80th anniversary of For Whom the Bell Tolls. So after the conference comes through Cook City, we're going to send people through Red Lodge, and we're trying to set up an event where we're going to show For Whom the Bell Tolls at the Roman Theater in Red Lodge. So be able to see the movie on the 80th anniversary of the book in the hometown of Robert Jordan. Should be a pretty special event for the Hemingway folks and for all of you if you want to involve yourselves. The date of that would be July 26th. The actual conference is July 19th through 25th, but I'm trying to set up an event in Billings for the night before. That would be the 18th, and an event in Red Lodge on the night after, which would be the 26th. So the last, I think, really, I mean, he touches on Montana and Across the River and Into the Trees, while the protagonist of that book, Colonel Cantwell, also hails from Montana. And his driver is from Wyoming. And as they drive around Italy on their way back to the place where Hemingway was injured, they're arguing about what's the toughest town in the world. And Hemingway's arguing for Venice at the time. And, of course, the guy from Jackson's arguing for Gillette and Rawlins and all these Wyoming towns. And then at one point, Cantwell counters him, and just to shut him up, he says, "Okay, Jackson, maybe we move in different circles, or maybe we have a differing definition of the word, but this town of Venice, with everybody being polite and having good manners, is as tough as Cook City, Montana, on the day they have the old-timers fish fry." So there, yeah, Hemingway uses Cook City as the standard for what constitutes a tough town. And then the final example would be A Man of the World, which is Hemingway's final short story. And I will try to keep this short, but I presented a paper in Paris last year at the International Hemingway Conference that basically establishes A Man of the World as Hemingway's final story, and then establishes the setting as Cook City, Montana. And so it was some of this research that I think convinced the society to bring their next conference to Cook City. But that is... there's a whole appendix on that at the back of the book, so we will get into that next year if you guys are interested. In 1932, as soon as he got to Cook City, he sat down and wrote Light of the World, which takes place in a little cafe or bar, and it's a creepy little story. But I think it's always been assumed that it was set in Michigan, but it could very well be Livingston. It's a train track at the end of the road. They smell the lumber mill. There's like pelts hanging and hunting going on, and there's just absolutely no reason it couldn't be Livingston. So there might be a lot more research to do. So hopefully this will just be a start.